Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but Please hold your calls until I ask for them, because we have with us this evening Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine. Dr. Nicholson is certainly one of the world's best known researchers, scientific researchers, and we really want to develop his thoughts before we open up for calls. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be on your show again.
Well, we were going to talk tonight, really, what, about more of these chronic diseases? What was the subject we decided to discuss?
Well, I thought we were going to concentrate more tonight on coronary diseases, on heart disease, arteriosclerosis, and other vascular diseases, which are the major killer, the number one major killer in our country today.
All right, fine. But, of course, the traditional thought, and when I went to medical school, well, that was just arteriosclerosis, you know, the fat problems, and, of course, the calcification of the fat that was in the artery. And so we always just assumed, well, it was mechanical, and there really wasn't much more that could be done for it. But a lot of new ideas are out there, aren't there?
Yes, there are. And we've been working on some of this ourselves, actually, particularly the infectious basis for heart disease. Not too much is really known about this, although within the last year or so, I think it's become a very hot topic. And that is that a lot of the types of infections that we actually work with in other contexts, in the context of various chronic illnesses, invade the vascular endothelial cells. These are the cells that line all the blood vessels of our body, including the heart. And these types of infections can set up an inflammation in the vascular cells, and this can result in all kinds of blood disturbances. And also, it can result in changes in the vascular system itself. And this turns out to be very, very important in terms of the types of lipids, the types of chemicals that are present in the blood. And some of this is very deleterious to our systems. And these types of infections can also invade the tissue of the heart, as well as many other tissues and virtually any organ in the body. But when they invade the heart tissue, they can set up, again, an inflammation of the heart, and this causes all kinds of problems with the heart arrhythmias, with heart problems, inflammation of the heart, and so on. And this, we think, is a major cause of heart disease today, but it's not really well recognized. It's becoming increasingly more recognized now, but I think until this year or last year, it really wasn't recognized how important these chronic infections are in heart disease.
Well, now, what sort of chronic infections? I know one of them, of course, would be chlamydia. Would mycoplasma fit into this, or what are the organisms we're talking about?
Well, we're talking about intracellular bacteria, and of the intracellular bacteria that can do this, that is, can invade the blood vessels and eventually the heart. Certainly, mycoplasma falls in this category, but also a very important one is chlamydia pneumoniae. And this type of chlamydia is the airborne chlamydia, not the sexually derived or sexually transmitted chlamydia. And this type of chlamydial infection turns out to be very important now in heart disease. But there are also other types of intracellular infections, even those associated with Lyme disease, for example, like Borrelia, other types of chronic illnesses, chronic fever illnesses caused, for example, even by Coxiella, which causes Q fever, another type of chronic condition. But all these chronic bacterial and sometimes viral conditions, such as human herpes virus 6, for example, which can invade the vascular cells, set up an inflammation of the blood vessels, and this predisposes people to major heart attacks down the road because it changes the blood chemistry, and it changes the chemistry of the blood vessels itself. And I think this is going to be very, very important in the future.
Well, you know, I look back on my years in medical school, and certainly most of these things, we knew there was a herpes virus, but I don't remember anything about herpes virus 6. Chlamydia was something that really came on long after I graduated from medical school. It's the same thing. Mycoplasmas were probably known to bacteriologists, but they were not something that was taught in, certainly in medical school. Lyme disease didn't even exist at that time. I think that came along about 1969, and I think, of course, Q fever has been around for a long time, but most of these seem to be relatively new, or are certainly relatively new, being recognized as pathogens, aren't they?
Well, some of them have been around a long time. For example, like Brucella, another intracellular bacteria that falls in this category, chlamydia, they've been in mycoplasma, been around a long time. But they're now considered to be emerging in terms of the disease categories. And the reason they're considered emerging is that I think we recognize them finally. But also they're increasing in incidence in the population along with the increase in these problems like heart disease and vascular disease, which are increasing in incidence. And it's not all diet and it's not all genetics. There is a major component due to the infectious process, I believe, that sets up a very large proportion of patients that have heart disease. It sets them up for that. And, of course, the other factors play a major role, too. It's not that I'm discounting that. But one of the factors that really hasn't gotten the attention that it needs is the fact that many patients with these heart conditions have these infections. Now, we kind of stumbled across this because, or stumbled onto this because when we were working with Gulf War illness right after the Gulf War, we noticed that some of the major complaints were vascular complaints that these veterans had. And eventually some of them progressed to have some major heart disease problems, and eventually many of them died, actually, of heart attacks. And we had a number of patients who were in their 20s who had major heart problems in their 20s with no family history of heart disease, no heart problems before they were deployed to the Persian Gulf. And they came back, and now they had major problems. And a lot of it centered around, in the case of the veterans, mycoplasmal infections in inflaming their vascular systems and inflaming their heart and causing major problems. And eventually their hearts gave out. And in several cases, these people were candidates for heart transplants. And until we discovered that they had this infection, the cardiologist didn't know what to do with them. They had absolutely no idea what was going on, and they just thought that, well, this is somebody that's having their heart is failing at a very young age. But they had all kinds of other vascular problems as well, not just the heart, but the entire vascular systems were inflamed. Once we successfully treated the infection in these patients, their hearts recovered. And one of the patients who I can talk about, because I have permission from this patient and his family, from Michigan, from Flint, Michigan, 26 years old, waiting for a heart transplant. His heart function was down to 10% ejection fraction. In other words, he was barely alive. And they were keeping him on standby status for a heart machine just because they were worried that his heart was going to give out before they could find a donor. Well, they never really found a good match or a good donor. In the meantime, I convinced his cardiologist that after we tested his blood that he had a major Mycoplasma fermentans infection. And so they had nothing to lose because he was going to die unless they could find a donor. So they put him on intravenous antibiotics, and he started to slowly recover. And finally, after about a year of therapy on and off, he left the hospital. He's now working, has a full-time job. His heart function is back up to about 70%. He's still going to have problems down the road because it was a major stress on his heart, but I'm sure it saved his life. His cardiologist felt that it saved his life. These are the kinds of things which are fairly extreme, but there are a lot of other cases which are not as extreme as that, but nonetheless, I think, are on the pathway towards major problems unless these infections are identified and treated.
Well, now, is this something that in years past we would have thought was simply myocarditis? Of course, we always thought myocarditis was simply a vascular infection. Is this what we were seeing 30 years ago as myocarditis, or is this a relatively new condition?
Well, it is myocarditis, but it's also endocarditis and pericarditis. And the problem is that it's all of these if you have these severe infections, and that's the difference, I think, between something you can get a heart infection, which will weaken your heart, but if you have one of these very vicious infections, it virtually attacks every part of your heart. It attacks the muscle. It attacks the endothelium, which lines the heart. It attacks the nerves in the heart. It attacks the valves of the heart. It goes after every major structure within the heart. And so your heart just cannot fight back from all this. These insults really weaken the heart to the point where it's crippled, more or less, and it really can't function so well. And all the arrhythmias and all the problems and inflammation and so on, and the degeneration of the heart valves and so on, make it almost impossible after a while for the heart to function properly, and so it just gives out.
Well, now, of course, you would think that the doctors would pick up on this, you know. Is there a leukocytosis? And for our listeners, that's an increased white cell or an increased sed rate. Are all the other stigmata of infection there, or are these such latent infections that even though they are life-threatening, the average doctor is not going to recognize them?
Well, the average, for example, cardiologist is going to look at the heart and concentrate, for example, on the nerve conduction in the heart, the electrical properties of the heart, and of course those are changed because of these infections. But they won't really take it like an infectious disease approach to the problem. I think that's beginning to change now, but it was understood for a long time that there are metabolic changes, and one of the changes we see in the vascular system during these infections is the increase in coagulation, that is the increase in blood clots that are present in the blood. When you just take a sample of venous blood, there's a very high number of the clots are above normal or above what that individual patient should have, and that's a telltale sign. So the clotting mechanisms are altered, and of course when you have these clots, then these clots can plug up arteries and cause problems itself. Whenever they start plugging up arteries, of course, and causing occlusions, then the heart tissue can't get the oxygen it needs, and so it eventually becomes ischemic. It may be in small zones initially, but if a major vessel is blocked, you know, that can lead to a massive heart attack.
Well, you know, of course, the government would admit to maybe 8,000 or 9,000 boys who came back Gulf War illness dying. Of course, that would be just totally out of proportion, which you'd anticipate. You know, out of the 697,000 soldiers or men and women we had in the Gulf area, but you think that the figure is closer to what, 28,000 or 29,000 have died?
I think it is, and those are reports that we've gotten from people within the Pentagon. Those are, unfortunately, the numbers are classified, so we have no way to know what the accurate numbers really are. But I have no reason to disbelieve the numbers that were given to me by people within the Pentagon. So I think it's much, much higher than has actually been reported. And I think that is a telltale sign that something went very, very wrong with the Gulf War. And of course, we're beginning to see some problems with Gulf War too. In the news reports recently, they have admitted that at least 100 patients have come down with an unusual pneumonia that they can't explain. And they've only explained a very small number of cases. They can't explain the other cases. And so we think that, again, these unusual stealth infections may be involved in those cases, because ordinarily you should be able to find the pathogen fairly quickly in an acute case of pneumonia.
Well, of course, it was your work that showed that about 40% of the Gulf War illness veterans that had the Gulf War illness had a mycoplasm. Were most of those this mycoplasm fermentis incognitus?
Yes, about 80% of the veterans that we tested, and that's backed up by two other studies, one in Texas and one back east. And so there are actually four laboratories that have done studies, and they're pretty close agreement in terms of the high frequency of Mycoplasma fermentans in the cases. And about 40% of the Gulf War illness cases are positive for mycoplasmal infection, but 80% of those are Mycoplasma fermentans. Now, most of these Gulf War veterans, if they were civilians, would be diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome patients. And when you examine chronic fatigue syndrome patients in the civilian population, you do see a high percentage of mycoplasmal infections. About 50% of them, or about one half of them, are positive. But you don't see 80% positive for fermentans. You see a collection of different mycoplasmas. In the United States, for example, the most common one found is Mycoplasma pneumoniae. In Europe, the most common mycoplasma found is Mycoplasma hominis in a study we did with the Free University of Brussels. So you do see different types of species of infection depending upon the location. But you also see multiple infections. In many of these patients, they have multiple mycoplasmal infections. They also have other bacterial infections. Some of them also have chlamydia pneumoniae. Some of them have viruses as well. We didn't see that in the Gulf War veterans. Primarily, they had this one infection. Also, we found a very high percentage, high relative to the general population, and also high relative to other chronic fatigue syndrome patients, of Mycoplasma genitalium. And we didn't expect that at all. And so these two, fermentans and genitalium, were very high in the Gulf War veterans, and we didn't expect that combination, just from what we've seen in the civilian population with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome. So something happened over there that was very specific. And there are several reports that are tracing this back to the vaccines, the multiple vaccines that were given during deployment. We don't know whether we're going to see this same pattern or same problem again in Gulf War II, but I suspect we're going to have some of the same problems because some of the same vaccines are being used, like the anthrax vaccine and some of the other vaccines. So we never really learned our lesson from the first Gulf War, and I think history is going to repeat itself, probably not as bad as the first Gulf War, but we're going to have some casualties due to these chronic illnesses.
Well, before we get back to the cardiac part, which I think is fascinating, I just wanted to ask you, what about this concept that many of the wives of the Gulf War veterans who were sick, many of the wives had a similar illness and similar organisms. Did you run into that at all?
Oh, yes. In fact, we just published a paper which just came out in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome where we studied the families of Gulf War veterans. And we first followed these families. If a Gulf War veteran was positive, and most of them were positive for mycoplasmal infections that we studied, we put them in a special category. We then started asking questions about their family members. And sure enough, there was a very high proportion of family members of these Gulf War veterans who also were symptomatic, had similar signs and symptoms to the veteran, and when we tested them, they also had the same infection. What we found was that the spouses came down with the problem first. They became symptomatic generally before their children, with some exceptions where they came down about the same time, but the children never came down first. Usually the spouses came down first and they tested positive first, and then one by one the children would come down positive. They would have a slightly different constellation of signs and symptoms compared to their parents, and the most common problem in terms of diagnosis of these young patients were autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So these two conditions, which are unknown in the population, although in California here there's been a 500% increase in autism rates, for example, in the last few years, and that was just documented recently by the state of California. And there are some of the toxic exposures that have been traced to autism or, for example, heavy metals and other things, but nobody has really focused very much on these chronic infections and the role that they might play, and I think they're going to be important.
All right, fine. Well, now we were talking about the cardiac disease, and it sounds like we're going to have to go to a break. When we get back, of course, we'll explore more of this. It's not only the mycoplasma, but a number of these other various low-grade infections can produce, of course, not only cardiac disease, but arteriosclerosis, which, of course, really, of course, can affect any part of the body, cutting off the blood supply. And, of course, is this reversible? Of course, they tell us we're supposed to just change our diet and but, of course, this is an infection there. It's going to need a much, much different approach. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson of the Institute of Molecular Medicine right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson. We've been talking about these chronic infections that affect the blood vessels. And, of course, I was raised as well. You just got to get these people to stop eating fats and get their cholesterol down. But is this as important as addressing the infectious aspect, or is it a combined approach?
Well, it has to be a combined approach. I mean, we know that diet is very important, not only in terms of helping to control infections, but I think it's essential in allowing patients to recover from these kinds of conditions. If they get these sorts of infections, their metabolism, their body metabolism will be changed, and so it's very essential to try and get it back to normal. And diet is one of the techniques that we recommend to do that. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the things that we recommend. So we usually have diets depending upon the condition. Part of this is on our website, by the way, if people probably should give that because
you go right ahead.
It's www.immed.org. It's like immediate.org. And on the website, if you'll go under treatment considerations, there are publications, for example, on diets and dietary advice. There are publications on advice on how to treat chronic infections or how chronic infections are found, the diagnosis of chronic infections. There's information on antibiotics. There's information on Lyme disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, Gulf War illness, so on and so forth. A lot of these chronic conditions that we're seeing in increasing incidence that we never saw, as you mentioned, 20, 30 years ago. People are very interested in these topics, and I think the reason they are is because often their physicians don't know a lot about them, and so they're in the dark. Their physicians are in the dark. There's just not very much information out there about these kinds of conditions and what causes them. And of course, psychiatrists have gotten their hands in this, and a lot of these people have been diagnosed with somatoform disorders, stress disorders, and so on. Basically because their diseases or their conditions were of unknown etiology. No one knew exactly what caused it, so it was easier to focus on a psychiatric reason for the disease and giving these people tranquilizers and antidepressants and so on and so forth did correct at least some of the signs and symptoms. But if you have a heart condition, giving an antidepressant is not going to do the job.
No, and of course, by the time you get through worrying about having the heart condition, well, you probably need a psychiatrist. But probably better to get to the real cause of this. And of course, you mentioned things like Lyme disease and the organism that causes Q fever and human herpes virus 6. Did you say Brucella?
Yes, I did.
That's what you used to call undulant fever.
That's correct, and it's now called brucellosis.
Right.
I'm trying to write up a paper on this. I've been so busy, I haven't really been able to finish it, but we did a study. We did actually two studies. One, we did a study on Gulf War veterans, and we found some cases there, but we also did a study on chronic fatigue syndrome in rural areas, and we found quite a few patients were infected with brucella. I guess it's not too surprising, but I didn't expect to see quite the incidence that we found.
No, that's because it's a disease of cows, isn't it?
Well, it's carried by livestock. It's endemic to livestock. It's also endemic to certain areas around the world. And, of course, in the Middle East is one of these areas where livestock can have brucella infection passed to humans.
All right, we'll be right back in just a moment. And our guest, of course, is Dr. Garth Nicholson. And we've just been talking about the fact that many of these chronic infections are related to the brucella organism. Now, that's, of course, brucellosis. When I went to school, we called it undulating fever, a disease of cows, and they would have repeated abortions, and it was a terrible problem in livestock, so they had vaccines for it, and they seemed to have it pretty well controlled. But Dr. Nicholson is pointing out that this is endemic in many parts of the world, and certainly in the rural areas where they've done their evaluation, looking at people who had chronic fatigue syndrome, they found a fairly high incidence of brucella infection that were totally unsuspected. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that would be a fair statement. And we've had some samples sent from various rural areas around the United States where they couldn't explain a chronic condition. They could call it chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome or whatever, and we were able to find brucella infections in these cases. These are the ones that we studied were from Texas, Utah, Kansas, Colorado, and so on. So areas where you'd expect to see them. But we also found a few in urban areas, which really surprised me.
And of course,
so they're around.
The thing is that these are treatable conditions if you recognize them.
Yes, they are. In fact, if you have a diagnosis for this, it can be treated.
And of course, can these, the brucella and the Q fever and the Lyme disease, the organism you talked about, Borrelia, can that actually, of course, infect the arterial walls and, of course, it contribute to this, what we have traditionally called arteriosclerosis?
Yes, it can. And there are now a number of different infections that are associated with that condition. and not only the types of bacteria that we've been discussing, but other bacteria types as well, and certain viruses as well. So it's a much more complicated situation. We never thought it was particularly simple when we started finding viruses and other bacteria associated with these infections. And if you take a complicated illness like Lyme disease, you can see why it's so difficult to treat, because often patients have a half a dozen different infections, mostly bacterial but some viral as well. And one of the most common, in addition to the Borrelia, which is the Lyme's organism, are mycoplasmal infections in about 65 to 70% of the cases. So, and there's some other bacteria as well. And anyway, it's becoming a more and more complicated situation. Some of these infections are caused by rickettsial infections, and these are mostly insect-borne infections. It used to be that we would find these more in tropical areas, but now they've found their way into the United States, and I anticipate that in the future we'll see more and more rickettsial infections associated with the chronic illnesses.
But of course, we used the when I was going to medical school, of course, that was a long, long time ago. When you had a rickettsial illness, the old Rocky Mountain spotted fever and Q fever, and so many of these others, they were always felt to be acute, fulminating conditions. And you're describing them as chronic diseases, chronic disabling.
That's correct. And of course, there are many types of rickettsial infections, just like there are many types of mycoplasmal infections. And some of these are more acute, and some of them are more chronic. Most of the mycoplasmal infections, for example, are chronic. They're very slow-growing microorganisms, and many of the microorganisms that we've been discussing this evening are very slow-growing. And you have these slow-growing intracellular microorganisms, and so they don't really stimulate an acute phase clinical situation. Most of what they do is chronic.
And of course, some of them you really can't find the antibodies for, can you?
No, you can't, because they hide inside the cells, and so they don't really stimulate much of an antibody response, and that's another reason why they are so difficult to find.
And, of course, this is the problem that the average doctor faces. I mean, he's trained to look for antibodies. He's trained to look for a leukocytosis. He's trained to look for an elevated sedimentation rate. These are the signs of infection. At least that's the way we always used to look at it. And now we're suddenly facing an entirely a new set of infections that, tragically, until recently, were very, very poorly understood. And I think in most instances are still poorly understood. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's a very fair statement. And we've been trying to spread the word, but, you know, it's very hard to get people to change their ways. And I know that, and so do you. I mean, I taught in medical school for almost 30 years, and it's very, very hard to change the patterns of education.
Well, I think it's vitally important that we do, though, and especially now when we have something that will offer the possibility of reversing arteriosclerosis, you know, other than major surgery. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we'll get somewhat into the treatment of this, or really sort of go where he knows. He's the expert on it. I'm just probably learning as much as our listeners out there are concerned. And this may seem to be, well, this is pretty philosophical, but you must understand we're talking about things that affect large numbers of people here in this country and are very, very, very poorly understood. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. His website, you'll want to go there if you have access to the Internet, immed.org. That's immed.org. Fascinating, fascinating material that you're not going to find most places. Now, Dr. Nicholson is certainly not a casual actor in this. When I first met him, he had published about 450 peer-reviewed articles. But in my position, when I come on the air, I've got to represent myself as knowing what we're doing, and I'm certainly not going to put somebody on my program and attest to their authenticity without checking it. So we went down to the medical library at our local hospital, and I asked them to start pulling up the papers, and we got called away, and I came back about 20 minutes later, and here sits this secretary. She's surrounded by piles of paper on the floor, and she's got about 250 summaries of Dr. Nicholson's articles, and she said, "Do you want me to pull down all 400 of them?" And I said, "No, I think that'll be fine." And now we're up to about 550 peer-reviewed articles. Dr. Nicholson is certainly one of the best known of researchers in the entire nation on these fields, and certainly we've talked to people in the scientific field who verify his position. So what you're hearing is really the cutting edge of what's going on in medicine today. And of course, we're dealing, of course, the tragedy with the Gulf War illness. We sent over almost 700,000 healthy young people over to the Gulf. And, well, the government will admit over 200,000 have applied for disability, and thousands of them are dead. And nobody wants to talk about that. And now we have our new boys back over in the Middle East again, coming down with mysterious illnesses. So, but let's get back to what we know about arteriosclerosis and about the ravages that can be produced, not necessarily by simply what we've been told in the past, and that is by depositions of fatty material. And there is depositions of fatty material, but many of this is actually precipitated by these low-grade chronic infections, which are almost impossible to pick up unless you know what you're looking for. So, Dr. Nicholson, what would the doctor, if we had a doctor out in the listening audience tonight, how would he go about approaching something of this sort? How would he be able to identify if there really is one of these chronic infections and which one it is?
Well, I think the first telltale sign are the coagulation disturbances. So if there is a difference in sedimentation rate, a difference in the coagulation patterns of the blood, a difference in some of the mediators of coagulation, that's a telltale sign that something's going on. Most of these infections that we've been discussing tonight cause inflammation of the blood vessels. This is a condition that's called vasculitis, and I think this is a kind of the precursor condition to not only arteriosclerosis, but also heart disease itself. So this is kind of the beginning of that process. And of course, there are disturbances with the blood proteins and the blood lipids. There are disturbances with the vessel wall, and because of inflammation and because of deposition of lipids and other components of minerals and so on in the vessel wall, this is the beginning of arteriosclerosis. And I think infection, at least in some patients, may play a major role in this whole process. And it can certainly accelerate it if it's there naturally anyway. So how do you control this? Well, the first thing, if you get tested, for example, and you do have coagulation disturbances and they're not corrected by diet alone and antioxidants alone, then there's something else going on. And the next thing I think I would check for is to see if any of these chronic infections are present, because if they are, they can be treated. And we've seen people turn around in terms of major vascular problems and major heart disease, but I don't think they would have turned around if we hadn't recognized these infections and their role in heart inflammation and heart disease and vascular disease and gotten them appropriate treatment.
Now, of course, then would this be done with a blood specimen and then cultures for these various organisms? Or would they be PCR tests for the organisms, or would it be some sort of panel? Because we're talking about not one organism, but a number of organisms that produce these chronic infections.
That's correct. And usually the most sensitive way to find these intracellular microorganisms is a molecular test like PCR. Unfortunately, they don't kick off the antibodies so much because they don't stimulate a major immune response. So it's very hard to find many of these infections by a change in the antibody titers from a blood serum sample. So unfortunately, usually we have to take a blood sample and look in the white blood cells of the blood. And if we find any of these microorganisms in the white blood cells, that is a bad, bad sign. And that indicates that there's probably a systemic infection. It's probably not just in the blood cells. It's all over the body in various compartments and various organs and so on.
Now, how do you find the infection in the white cells? I mean, is this culture process? You say you look at them. I mean, do you examine them under a microscope? And we mentioned PCR, and probably for our listeners out there, they don't even know what that would represent.
Well, briefly, what PCR does is a genetic amplification technique. So it's just like amplifying a small genetic segment that's unique, for example, to a microorganism. So we know that there are genes in these microorganisms that have unique structures that typify them as, for example, bacterial genes rather than mammalian genes. And because of their sequence, they encode different types of molecules. And so we get usually a unique gene that we will follow. And they will amplify a small region of that gene with a unique genetic sequence. And we may amplify it to make a million copies of that genetic sequence. And then we can analyze the sequence and see if it's bacterial or see if it's something else. And usually then we can confirm whether it's the appropriate sequence to identify a specific type of bacteria or not. And then I think that's a pretty good indication that the microorganism is present. If its genes are there, it's a good indication that it's there as well.
All right, and so that basically then it's a genetic sequencing, and of course I don't think we want to get too far into the details of how you do it, but you're able to genetic sequence, and you can pick up then which of these various chronic disease organisms is present in the blood specimen.
That's correct, and of course you have to have an idea what's there. If you don't have any idea at all, then it's just hard to know where to start. But if you have an idea, and of course I've mentioned some of the possible infections, and mainly those are ones that have been found at reasonable frequency. So those are the ones that you really want to try and have the test run for. And if you find those, then that just by the type of microorganism that's present, we pretty much know how to treat those infections, although they're not easy to treat. This is one of the major problems that we found with these types of chronic smoldering or slow-growing intracellular infections. They're very difficult to treat. Now, normally, rapidly growing bacteria are really quite simple to treat. A 10-day course of antibiotics is generally sufficient, and that's generally enough to wipe them out. But the slow-growing chronic intracellular bacteria, like the mycoplasma, chlamydia, borrelia, these things are growing so slowly, and they have a quiescent phase as well to their growth cycle. It's very difficult using a short period of antibiotic treatment to knock them out. In fact, the best you can do is simply slow their growth. But long-term treatment is necessary to really make a dent in these types of infections.
Well, of course, my understanding is that this, at least with the chlamydia infections in arteriosclerotic plaques, that these plaques that narrow down the artery, which before we would either have to do a coronary bypass or go ahead and put in some sort of a coronary artery stent, that these will actually melt away and the process is reversible.
Well, it seems to be reversible. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, some of the examples of the Gulf War veterans, now these were fairly young individuals, and so I think they had a pretty good capacity to repair once the infectious process was stopped. But there's no reason why we can't see a reversal. And I use my father as an example. My father had an unknown heart condition. It was literally destroying his heart valve. And he also had swelling of the heart and arrhythmias and so on. And they gave him about 6 months to live. And there were some other suspicious things about his condition. So I tested him and found out that he was positive for Mycoplasma pneumoniae. And he was treated on several cycles of azithromycin and eventually fully recovered. And, gee, he's lived many years after that. He's now 91 years old. And his heart's in pretty good shape. He goes to the gym twice a week now. So here's a situation where the cardiologists have virtually given up on him, but we didn't give up on him. Of course, he was lucky.
We were lucky he had you as for a son. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And so if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question and you'd like to talk to Dr. Nicholson, here's a unique opportunity because, of course, Dr. Nicholson is on the cutting edge of this whole approach to many of these chronic degenerative diseases. But right now, of course, we're talking about of the diseases as they affect the arteries, and of course these can be anywhere within the body, that of course you can get this vasculitis, a secondary infection, and then deposition of certainly of the atherosclerotic plaques, and then, of course, a progressive narrowing of the artery, and it can lead to a stroke or a heart attack or other terrible, terrible disability. And the fact that that some of this may very well be reversible with, of course, conservative treatment, and conservative treatment would be long-term antibiotic treatment, is really an exciting thing to contemplate. So if you have a question, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Now, you know, one of the things that really is so disabling today is this condition of Lyme disease. And now, you know, even in my own community, there's a Lyme disease support group. There's support groups all across America. I don't think the average individual has any idea how many people have this terrible, terrible disease that is really incapacitating them to the point where they just can't be productive at all.
Well, you know, it's surprising that there's so many people now coming down with Lyme disease. This is generally a tick-borne disease. We've studied a few patients, but not nearly as many as some of the laboratories back east where there's a major epidemic of Lyme disease. But basically, the results that we found are very similar to one of our sister labs back on the East Coast. And basically, they find that Lyme disease, of course, it involves the Borrelia, spirochete microorganism, but it also involves other bacteria as well, and mycoplasma is one of the most commonly found bacteria, and mycoplasma fermentans is one of the most commonly found mycoplasma in Lyme disease patients. And of course there are other types of infections too. Ehrlichia is one of the types of infections that they can have, Babesia infections and other viral infections. So these are very complex infectious processes, and I think that's one of the reasons why those patients are so difficult in terms of their management, is they have these multiple infections. And when you have multiple infections, the microorganisms may have different antibiotic sensitivities, for example. They may have different life cycles. They may have different cells that they've infected, and so on and so forth. And this really makes for a very complex situation, and the Lyme disease patients are complex. They have a lot of problems, and it's very difficult in terms of their management. And there are very few physicians who will take on Lyme disease patients because they are difficult management problems.
Well, I think that, you know, from my point of view, with my limited knowledge, I always assume that here you have a patient, they have a spirochetal infection, you treat the infection, the patient gets better. Trouble is, you treat the patient with a proper antibiotic, and the patient doesn't get better. And then, of course, you get very, very defensive, you know. The patient should get better. They're not getting better. And if you don't recognize the multiple infection aspect of this, why, it does nothing but create confusion.
Well, again, as I said, they're complex infectious processes. And so, you know, once you understand that, it's much easier to understand why these infections are so difficult to treat. Now, a lot of other chronic patients have these multiple infections as well. It's not unique to Lyme disease patients. We know a lot of chronic fatigue syndrome patients and fibromyalgia syndrome patients have multiple infections as well. In fact, in a European pathology journal, we just have a recent article that just came out a couple weeks ago, and I'm actually pretty proud of that article because it took many years to produce the study. And basically, we looked at several different types of chronic infections in a group of 200 chronic fatigue syndrome patients. And what we found was is that if the patients had multiple infections, the severity of their signs and symptoms was significantly greater than the patients that had, let's say, only one infection, or we couldn't detect an infection in them. So if they had even more than one, if they had two infections, again, it jumped up again. And finally, if they had three infections, it turned out to be insignificant, three or more, so we grouped them all as three or more infections. So there seems to be a relationship between the number of infectious agents and the degree of the severity of the signs and symptoms. Now, the interesting thing was that it didn't matter from the group of infectious agents that we were looking at which combination was present in the patient. The important thing was the multiple infections. So that kind of simplifies things a little bit. We expected that we might find different combinations which produced you know, the most severe signs and symptoms, but that's what we expected, but that's not what we found. So often, you know, you expect certain things in science and medicine, but that's not always what you find.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a question. A few minutes ago, you all were talking about Gulf War vets with heart conditions related to exposures in the Gulf. And the recommendation was psychiatric drugs.
Well, this is what so patients. Often is done. This is not what they need, but this is what they're given.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to ask was, what's the likelihood of those drugs exacerbating heart conditions?
Well, they're certainly not going to help it. And of course, if they do have an infectious process and they're just simply given psychotropic drugs, antidepressants, for example, and other things that don't really have any effect on the infection per se, the only effect that they have is a potential deleterious effect because some of the antidepressants will suppress the immune system. So it's kind of counterproductive in my way of thinking to treat these types of chronic conditions with psychotropic drugs.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Good, thanks.
Okay, let's go to Gloria calling in from, of all places, Spokane, Washington. Hi, Gloria, how are you?
Hi. Yes, Dr. Nicholson, I did have the mycoplasma test, and I just got the results. They were negative. I do have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And we sent the test, to medical diagnostics laboratories. And I looked on the back of the form when they were drawing the blood, and there were so many tests. The doctor just ordered the mycoplasma because I specifically asked him to, two different panels. Was he supposed to order something else? Because I'm a little confused about that.
Well, again, I don't know the specifics. You could have your physician call me if he really doesn't know what test that he might order. There are a number of chronic infections that have been associated, for example, with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. So, it's not everyone has the same infection. Quite the contrary.
Well, now, of course, from Gloria's point of view, let's imagine that Gloria was a patient, and you were, of course, I'm not asking you to try to diagnose over the telephone, but somebody comes in, they have chronic fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. So would you run some sort of a panel looking for mycoplasma, chlamydia, the Lyme disease, the spirochete, and three or four others? How would you approach this?
Well, that's exactly what we'd recommend, plus viruses like HHV6 as well. And at least if these are not present, you can rule that out.
Is that the PCR specialty test?
Normally, these are done, we recommend molecular tests. And the reason we recommend molecular tests like the PCR test is that they're the most sensitive.
Well, on your webpage, you recommend, it says, for best price and highest quality, I suggested the above PCR specialty test for CFIDS, FMS patients be ordered through medical diagnostic laboratories. And, I had given, my doctor, by the way, was very impressed with your website, by the way.
Well, thank you. We love to hear that.
Gloria, maybe we can get you a copy of this tape, and you can get it to your doctor
afterwards.
Yeah. Because we're going to be gone around for another hour anyway.
But the thing I do want to know real quickly is he ordered specifically the whole battery of tests for mycoplasma. Apparently there were two different batteries, and that was ruled out. But this PCR, what I want to know about that is PCR, because was that used in the mycoplasma test? I guess I'm a little...
Yeah.
I don't understand.
It probably was. But, of course, you can also get it. You can order antibody tests for things like mycoplasma, too. The risk you run there is the fact that not all mycoplasmal infections will stimulate an antibody response. And
okay,
the other problem with just simply looking at antibodies is you can't tell if there's an active infection because the antibodies can remain high for some time after there's no evidence of an active infection. So... it's a good idea to have a molecular test as a backup. Now,
referring to molecular testing.
Yeah, PCR testing is a molecular test. There are some other genetic type tests as well, but that's the most widely used clinical diagnostic approach or clinical diagnostic.
Well, there wasn't a place in our city that even knew what this was all about.
Well, that's
laboratory,
not a new...
and it's like, huh? What are...
She's in Spokane. Well, anyway, Gloria, was there anything else you wanted to ask? I would suggest that, is there some place where the panel is listed on your website, Dr. Nicholson?
Yes. Some advice on what types of tests to at least initially start with are on the website. Again, it's just advice. It's mainly there for physicians so that they would have an idea about what to order. But patients consult with that all the time, of course.
Okay, fine. And anything else?
Well, thank you. And I'm glad that at least my physician is aware of what you're organization, you know, teaches and the specialty tests. So that's good.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you so much for calling, Gloria. Our telephone
bye-bye.
Number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you want to give a call, if you're up in the Great Northwest listening to us tonight, our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of Molecular Medicine. And, of course, he has been fascinated in working with this field, these chronic infections, which really have such tremendous impact on our society. We're talking probably of, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Nicholson, but 800,000 to a million people with chronic fatigue syndrome, probably, what, a couple of a million with fibromyalgia?
Well, I think that both of those diseases probably are a couple million in our population. And again, it depends on the definition. If you use a looser definition that's not so restrictive, you find that there are probably several million people in the country that have this problem. One of the aspects of fatigue, which is so intriguing to me, is the fact that it's the most commonly reported complaint of patients seeking general medical care in North America. So this is a problem that's very widespread. Fatigue is a problem that's very widespread. Now, chronic fatigue is fatigue of 6 months or more duration, which is not resolved by rest, and there are a number of other criteria and so on. So that's a little bit different from just fatigue. And then chronic fatigue syndrome is a little bit different from just chronic fatigue. And so, you know, when the diagnosis gets more and more specific, of course, then there are more and more criteria which have to be fulfilled. But fatigue itself is a major problem.
Well, does the intercellular organism, you know, like the mycoplasma, does that attack certain components within the cell that promotes fatigue?
Yes, it does, and this is a something that I'm extremely interested in, and I've spent a lot of time in the last year or so focusing on this. We've run two clinical trials on this, actually. And what we were trying to find out is why this loss of energy, which is fatigue, really, why does this occur? And of course, we were focusing our attention on the little batteries in each of our cells. And the little batteries are called mitochondria, and they're what's known as an organelle in the cell. And they're the organelle that produces the energy for our cells. So all of the energy that we produce, pretty much all of it except for anaerobic energy, if there's no oxygen around, comes from our mitochondria. So we did a study to see if there was any impairment of the mitochondria, which is what we'd expect in chronic fatigue syndrome patients. And that's exactly what we found, and others have found it too, is that mitochondria are impaired. And they're impaired in a number of different ways, but the most important impairment turned out to be oxidative damage to their membranes. And the reason that was so important is that when the membranes and the lipids in the membranes are damaged by oxidation, they can't form a nice barrier to the mitochondria. They become leaky. And the mitochondria are like a little battery, only a battery, if you start ripping the insulation or interfering with the insulation of the battery, what happens? It runs down. It loses its charge, and it no longer functions anymore. And the same thing happens with our mitochondria. They can't undergo the chemical chain reactions called oxidative phosphorylation unless they have an intact functioning membrane that forms a barrier. And so we've started to look at this. The barrier is not completely destroyed, but it's impaired. And this also happens naturally with aging, by the way. One of the reasons why people that are approaching the later stages of their lives start to lose energy and so on, it's because their mitochondrial membranes get oxidized and the mitochondrial function goes down. So we have a way of actually measuring the mitochondrial function in patients. And we know in patients that have these infections, it's impaired. We know in elderly patients, it's impaired. We know in different conditions that we know are damaging the mitochondria that it's impaired. So we've been working with a couple of manufacturers of over-the-counter products that will supplement the membranes and try and replace some of the membrane lipids, and we've been working with one company in New York. We've and some of the publications are actually now on our website, and we've had some just striking results where we've been able to see within 60 days of taking this a food supplement a 40% increase in mitochondrial function and a concomitant decrease in the fatigue from severe fatigue down to moderate or mild fatigue.
Well, do the mitochondria actually have an electrical charge on them? You refer to them as batteries, but is there an electrical charge there?
Yes, there is. There's actually a chemical potential across the membrane which is necessary for the entire process to work. And if that is run down, then the electron transport chain won't work. And so without getting into a lot of detail that people couldn't follow, I use the battery analogy. It's more complicated than that, but that's a good analogy, and it seems to be understandable by most people.
Well, at least I can understand that. And, Chris, the thing that I would like to point out is that the mitochondria are simply portions of the cell. I mean, the cell is a very tiny thing, and we ordinarily think of the nucleus of the cell, but in the cytoplasm of the cell, there are all these various things. I don't even remember all of them. You probably do, having taught in medical school. I remember the Golgi apparatus and the mitochondria and three or four other things that have to do with the whole metabolism. And that cell is just like a little city, it's complete and function on its own and receives nutrition from the body. And, of course, anything happens, why, the whole thing begins to break down. We've got Bill calling us from Florida. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Hi, Dr. Nicholson.
Do you have a question or comment, Bill?
I had a question. Hypothyroidism, can that have the same or similar symptoms to CFIDS and fibromyalgia?
Well, you know, thyroid problems are very common in those two conditions, in chronic fatigue syndrome and in fibromyalgia syndrome. And one of the things that we've focused on in those patients when they have these problems, and by the way, it can be either underactive, which is hypothyroid condition, or overactive, hyperthyroid condition. And one of the things that we found is that whenever we see a very sluggish thyroid or very overactive thyroid, that it suggests that there may be thyroiditis. Now, thyroiditis is an infection of the thyroid, and it turns out that the types of infectious agents that we've been talking about often invade the thyroid gland. For example, mycoplasma, very common, we found that the thyroid gland is infected. And when this happens, this can cause either over or under production of the thyroid hormone. So that is a condition that is associated with the chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome.
And so basically the thyroid problem is secondary to the infection rather than causing it, okay?
Okay. In other words, a growth on the thyroid could cause you to be hypothyroid then.
You're really talking about infection of the thyroid, aren't you?
Yes, I'm talking about thyroiditis, not necessarily
this here. This here is like a cold nodule.
We're going to have to go, Bill. We're taking the break. You want to hang on till after break or not?
Just wanted to see if the TAC theory applies. In other words, if you get rid of the hypothyroidism and...
No, I think it would be the other. You get rid of the infection. We're going to have to go. We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Thanks so much. And right now, I want to say goodbye to our listeners up in the great state of Washington. And till tomorrow, Dr. Stan. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we certainly want to explore. Well, you can call in if you'd like to. We want to explore more about, of course, the attack on the heart, the attack on the vascular system, to chronic infection, and of course we've mentioned so many of the different infections, the mycoplasm, the Borrelia, the Brucella, the herpes 6, the Coxsella, various chronic chlamydia infections. All of these, of course, can have an impact. Now, ordinarily, you mentioned this chlamydia pneumonia. Is this a very, very prevalent infection today?
Well, I think it is. It's more prevalent than people think. And we know from our studies, for example, in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, that 10% of them have a chlamydial pneumonia infection. So it's not as high as mycoplasma, but it's reasonably high. In other conditions, it's also present in about that proportion. It may be actually in coronary artery disease patients, it may be even a little higher than that. And that's just one infectious agent. And so when you start adding up all the infectious agents that you could look at, and if they all even have a low incidence, by the time you add all these things up, you're talking about a fairly high or fairly reasonable incidence of infection in these conditions.
Well, now, if a doctor was looking for this as a cause of coronary artery disease, would he then run the complete panel looking for all of these various organisms, or would he just look for perhaps mycoplasma and chlamydia pneumonia? We're talking now, of course, as far as vascular disease is concerned.
Well, I think he's probably going to have to look at least a half a dozen of these things, because it's very hard to know in advance which ones are there. It'd be nice if they had, very unique characteristics, so that we could say, aha, there's a unique sign or symptom that's associated with one infection and not with another, and so we would know what test to run, but no such luck.
Well, now, why doesn't the body, react to these and, of course, control them? I mean,
well,
the immune system is an amazing, amazing phenomenon, and of course it's really what protects us from diseases. Is there something wrong in recent years with our immune system? Has this always been something that's been there and just hasn't been recognized, or is there some sort of defect that we have today that did not exist in generations past?
Well, I can't answer that. That's a difficult question to answer. But I can tell you that these intracellular infections do not stimulate the type of immunity that we see with the rapidly growing systemic infections that are all over the place and that are extracellular, for example. Those are recognized fairly quickly by the immune system, and immune response is mounted fairly quickly against them. These chronic conditions, one of the characteristics of these chronic conditions is that they actually tend to suppress the immune system. So they actually give off little chemicals that try and turn off the immune system. And this is their way of hiding from the immune system.
Now, are these new organisms, chlamydia pneumonia, has that always been around, or is that more pathogenic now than it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago? Is there any way of knowing?
I don't know that there's any way of knowing if it's more pathogenic or not, although with natural selection, it could be becoming more pathogenic. I just think that these things have just not been recognized, and they have been allowed to penetrate further and further into the population because no attention was really paid to them. And so people weren't treating them, they weren't recognizing them as a problem, and so on, so they've just had their way. Now I think once we start recognizing them as a problem and addressing that problem and treating them, we may be able to force them back again into the background.
Well, of course, it would seem to me that if, say, with something like the mycoplasma infection that can spread from the husband to the wife to the children, you know, you would simply, you know, have to, if you recognize that, could treat them and then could be using some sort of infection control, whether it be simply be washing your hands or whatever it would be, you know, to try to keep this from spreading to other people. Because, you know, if those children are going to school, I would think that other children in the school could come down with these diseases.
Well, that seems to be the case, because there are, you know, certain hot spots for these types of illnesses. And we do know that from just the, you know, the studies, and they haven't been very very good, I think, in terms of their quality, but some of the small studies that have been attempted, at least, show that teachers, healthcare providers, social workers, and so on, seem to be at higher risk than the general population to get these types of illnesses and these types of infections.
I remember reading about chronic fatigue syndrome, and there was members of an orchestra, and some of the members of the orchestra had the chronic fatigue syndrome, and there was somebody in New England, as I remember, that a whole flock of children in one area seemed to have come down ill. So they almost appeared in clusters. I know that there was a cluster of chronic fatigue that was seen at Incline Village in California. You know, but there were a group of people in that area, all of whom seemed to come down with these diseases.
Well, we tested some of the Incline Village patients and found that at least the ones that we tested had mycoplasmal infections. At the time we did this, we didn't have tests for some of the other things, and it'd be nice to go back and do a study, but it's many years since. So we do know that at least a few of the patients that we looked at did have these infections. And again, you know, one of the problems that we've seen, and just basically from the types of people out there have contacted us, is that there are certain professions where I think people are at higher risk. For example, in the healthcare professions, people are just being probably more exposed to these sorts of things than the average population. And again, they also recognize the signs and symptoms, perhaps, because of their training as well. But they seem to be at higher risk to get these infections, and that's what you'd expect. So actually, in the last month or so, I've been invited to speak at two dentistry-associated academies, the most recently the American Academy of Craniofacial Pain, and they're mostly oral surgeons and dentists that deal with, now they know, chronic infections that, for example, invade the bone in the face or invade the jawbone. I had this problem myself. These are very painful and very difficult infections to deal with. And so now they're finding that, gee, a lot of these chronic infections that we deal with systemically are also present as very difficult bone infections and very difficult infections in the oral cavity to deal with. And so if they're recognized early on, because often we think that they start there, that tends to be the place where they can then spread systemically. And that reminds me, and I was going to mention this, and I forgot to mention it earlier, there was just a study that came out, it was published about a week or two ago, which related a periodontal disease with heart disease. In other words, people that had first periodontal disease problems, root canals, infections of the oral cavity, particularly of the gums and so on, were much, much more likely to have heart disease down the road than people that didn't have those oral infections. And so, again, I think that points to the fact that, you know, once you get these infections, they can spread from the oral cavity and spread from the region of the face down to other organs like the heart and other organs, for example, the liver and the kidneys and the lungs and so on. But when they get in the heart, that's, of course, a particular problem in terms of our survival. So that's something that just came out, which I thought you might be interested in.
I am interested in. What about women, for instance, who do work in a dental office, cleaning teeth, things of that sort, dental technicians? Are they more prone to chronic fatigue than the general population?
Well, I really don't know that any studies have been done, but I can tell you I get a lot of calls from dental assistants, for example, dental hygienists, even people who work in dental offices that seem to have a lot of problems. So I think a study needs to be done on that, because if that's an occupational hazard, then we need to have a different approach in the way patients are dealt with and the way they're handled and so on and so forth. to prevent the types of exposures. Now, I know that dentists themselves have been taking more and more care these days. You know, a few years ago, you never noticed a dentist wearing a faceplate, for example. Now it's very common that they wear a face shield, a plexiglass shield that will wrap around their face, for example, and protect them from fluids that are flying around when they're working in your mouth to breathing on them and so on and so forth. So they're getting a little more conscious of these sorts of things and these problems.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great idea, and I just sort of, you know, looking back on my medical practice and experience, I've seemed to feel that many times it's the dental hygienists or, you know, people who work in the dental office that I seem to have somewhat higher rate of it, but it's simply an empirical observation rather than a statistical, and that's what you do, is you want to look at it from a statistical point of view and not simply go on what appearances is concerned. Well, you know, as we, of course, talk about the impact of these various organisms on the vascular system, are these, you mentioned there was just one rather dramatic case of a young man who's waiting to have a heart transplant, and of course he recovered simply with antibiotics. Have you had a fair amount of success in treating or looking at watching people who have treated these patients with a severe heart disability related to these infections or arteriosclerotic lesions related to the infections?
We haven't really done much on the arteriosclerosis end of it, although I think it's very important to see if that's a process that can be reversed. I think it's going to take a number of things to reverse that process once the plaque is actually formed on the vessel wall. On the other hand, the inflammation of the heart and the arrhythmias of the heart and the swelling of the heart and all these things that are associated with endocarditis and myocarditis, I think can be reversed, at least if we don't wait till the point where there's actual tissue death. Once the tissue death occurs, particularly of the nerve cells and of the muscle cells in the heart, then I don't think anything could be done. But if we get it early on, and I think now is the time to do that, when we first start seeing the arrhythmias, when we first start seeing the inflammation, when we first start seeing the changes in coagulation and so on and so forth that are telltale signs that there's vasculitis or inflammation of the vascular system going on, and then treat those patients, diagnose them, see if they've got any of these chronic infections, and if they do, treat them, I think we're going to be a lot further along.
Well, now you mentioned the problems with the coagulation. Would this be simply drawing a vial of blood? But ordinarily, blood will coagulate, you know, unless you have some sort of oxalate or other substance in with it. So how do you recognize the coagulation problem that you speak of?
Well, there are particular tests to do this, and there are ways in which the blood sample is handled so that essentially it's fixed in time and so that it won't just naturally coagulate any further than it's coagulated already. And so there are ways that any good laboratory know how to do this, and they know how to run the test. The tests are fairly routine, as it turns out.
Right, so you mean like bleeding and clotting time, things of that sort?
Yes, sedimentation rate, clotting time, so on and so forth. All these things are fairly routine, and they can be done by most laboratories, clinical laboratories.
All right, fine. So something out of the distant past, my memory. As an orthopedic surgeon, I didn't have to deal with that very often. I would always leave that up to the interns, let him worry about it. Well, now, of course, is this getting into the general medical literature? Is this, of course, you would be dealing with other scientists, but is this getting into the cardiology literature? Is this being discussed at all by people who are on the front lines treating patients?
Well, I think it's just beginning to be discussed. I know chlamydia pneumoniae now is a topic that is just beginning to be discussed. Mycoplasmal infections, I think that hasn't hit yet. It will eventually. And some of these other viral infections and so on, some have hit, some I think will hit in the future. But one of the things that cardiologists have not put together is they've tended to think of these as isolated situations. Somebody has a chlamydia pneumonia infection, that's an isolated situation. It's not an isolated situation. Those patients could have multiple infections, and we need to know that because it's not just one infection that we're generally dealing with. It's multiple infections, and these patients have been sick a long time in particular. So that's something we're going to have to somehow hammer into the cardiologists. It's going to take a while.
What happened to chlamydia? Pneumonia actually produced a pneumonia-type lesion?
Well, one of the telltale or the hallmarks of that type of infection is a community pneumonia, as it's called, and in fact, a non-viral pneumonia, and one that is not easy to identify in terms of its etiology. You know, acute pneumonias are fairly easy to identify, but they're a large class of pneumonias that they're called atypical pneumonias, and atypical because they're not so easy to find the etiologic agent that's causing the pneumonia. And these would be put in that category, atypical pneumonia.
Okay, and of course that can be mycoplasma, it can be chlamydia. And what else could do that?
Well, as we talked before, it could be Brucella, for example. Oh. It could be Coxiella. There could be a number of different chronic infections that could cause a pneumonia-like condition. And not every patient will come down with a pneumonia-like condition, let's say that has a chlamydia pneumonia infection or a mycoplasmal infection. And some people will have these more of an acute phase, and then it'll go into chronic phase, and they won't have the pneumonia any longer, but they'll have bronchitis that is a chronic condition that will continue on after the acute pneumonia phase has passed.
All right. Well, of course, these things, I mean, I can remember, I think probably in the 1980s, hearing about the atypical pneumonia. It may have been around before that, but I certainly wasn't well aware of it. And then, of course, we always attributed that to mycoplasma infections. And now, of course, it seems like there's a whole group of things that are producing these atypical pneumonias. And is this fairly widely recognized today?
Well, I really don't know, since, we're so absorbed in research on these different things that it's kind of hard for us to know exactly what the general medical community does out there. When I go to these conferences, like the two dental conferences that I just mentioned I went to, I get a much better feeling for what the general practitioner deals with, or in this case, the general dentist and the general oral surgeon and so on, the problems that they deal with and what they know about those problems and how they approach them. So I think it's a matter of education. It's just going to take some time.
Well, I know I go to the medical meetings on a regular basis just to find out what's going on. Lots of changes, but these are not the things that are being discussed today. And so for our listeners out there, you really want to get the information. And you want to, don't be ashamed or afraid to talk to your doctor and say, have you heard about this? Why don't you go to this website? And, of course, it's immed.org, and all sorts of fascinating material on that website, really that is designed to help your doctor begin looking into these various types of infections, low-grade infections, but they can produce so much disability. Well, herpes 6, I never remember. Is this a new disease, or has this always been around and only more recently recognized?
Well, I think it's been around for a long time, and it's been more recently recognized as one of the agents that seems to be involved in a number of chronic conditions, like chronic fatigue syndrome and some of the other chronic conditions. And one of the studies that I mentioned that just came out, we looked at this along with the mycoplasma and chlamydia and some other infections in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, and we found it in about 30% of the patients. And when we actually tried to look for groups of patients that might have these multiple infections, and one of the things that we did was we did a study to make it less complicated to your listeners. It focused on subsets of patients that had different types of infections and so on. And what we didn't see was that there was a sorting out of patients that had all of these infections. It was kind of random. If you had a mycoplasmal infection or you didn't have a mycoplasmal infection, you were just as likely to have or not to have an HHV6 infection. So it wasn't selecting with mycoplasma infections, for example. So all these tended to be independent variables, as we call them. So when we did the study, those independent variables, yes, that means that any one individual could have a number of these infections, and that's what we found. But they were acting kind of independently. And, if you think about where you might get these infections, you may pick up one infection from one place or one individual or one situation, and you might pick up another infection later on from another individual or another environment or so on and so forth. So they're not necessarily going together. Now, there's some exceptions to this, and I think Lyme disease is an exception. And the reason it's an exception is that the tick that bites you is carrying 10, 15, 20 different infectious agents in them. They're just a sack of infection. It's just really amazing. And we know that when actual ticks have been examined to see what types of infections are inside the ticks, the same ticks that are causing the Lyme disease, those ticks have mycoplasma, they have Borrelia, they have Ehrlichia, they have Babesia, they have other infectious microorganisms as well. So they've got all these things. And an individual that picks up the tick and the tick bites them and spreads some of these infectious agents in them, they're much more likely to get the multiple infections because the source has the multiple infections already.
Well, now, where does a tick get all of these things, though? Are these endemic in some sort of an animal? Do they get it from other ticks? I mean, there has to be some source for all these infections within the animal kingdom.
Well, you know, the ticks bite other animals that have these multiple infections, and they may get them that way. And these infections don't seem to harm the ticks in any way. They don't seem to bother the ticks in any way. So it doesn't interfere with the life cycle of the tick. So if it did, then, you know, we might see some of these as limiting types of infectious processes. As the ticks might die off, for example, and there wouldn't be a problem. But it doesn't seem to be affecting them as much as it affects us and affects other mammals.
But now, of course, is Lyme, is this this spirochete that causes Lyme disease carried by domestic animals? Is it carried by wild animals? Do we know where in society it comes from?
Well, we know that, for example, deer carry these ticks, and deer carry these infections as well.
Okay, deer have the infection then.
Yes, and, okay. And we know that certain birds may have them and so on and so forth. So these infections have been followed in certain types of animals. And so for the brown tick, for example, it's called the brown tick, they're much more likely to go into, spread into herds of deer and spread the infection that way, and then the ticks get spread as well and so on and so forth.
Well, now, of course, in years past, you know, we always had a sort of a species barrier that protected people from animal diseases. In other words, we don't get so many of the diseases the animals get. It seems that almost as if that species barrier protection is no longer effective.
That's correct. And with some of these diseases, whether they've adapted to multiple species, I don't know. But they don't seem to have that same barrier. And we don't know if that barrier ever existed, but at least the organisms that we've been talking about tonight do not seem to have a species barrier. So they can pass from livestock to humans or livestock to insects and insects to humans and so on and so forth.
And of course, Lyme disease was never seen before 1969. Maybe it was here, but I think that was the first cases were ever recognized back in Lyme, Connecticut.
Yes, there are a number of suspicious things with the Lyme disease and the fact that Plum Island is right across the sound from Lyme, Connecticut. And Plum Island is the U.S. Department of Agriculture isolation station for studying these types of insect-borne diseases. So, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, these ticks got out of the laboratory on Plum Island and birds picked them up, for example, and carried them over across the sound.
Well, we may never know the truth, but there's just so many more diseases that we are susceptible to, it seems, than ever before, and so many, many new diseases that have never been recognized before. I mean, some of these certainly may have been around, but some of them that we just have no record of. And certainly this chronic fatigue syndrome, which is just affecting so many people, you know, we, of course, there's always been people who are tired, but I think that there's so many more today than there were certainly when I went through medical school. The same thing too with fibromyalgia. We just didn't see people complaining, you know, this diffuse ache all over, disability. You know, when, I just don't remember ever hearing these stories before, but of course, 30 years later, why it was not uncommon to have them come into your office.
Well, there must be an increased incidence of this. The problem is that nobody has really been able to study this because it's very hard to go back in time and find out when does this all start and so on. We know the complaints were there, But they seem to be increasing. It seemed to be because it's very difficult to really do a study on this, because in the past we may not have asked the right questions.
May very well be, and of course it's all conjecture, but it is at least a worthwhile sorts of commenting on. Well, now, is there anything else that we should be covering as far as the infections of the heart or the vascular system that you'd like to cover?
Well, you know, we kind of stopped on our topic on mitochondria, these
all
little
right.
organelles that have something to do with fatigue. And I mentioned that we've just completed two clinical studies on this, and one of the products that we did a study on actually replaces the lipids of the mitochondria. Now, we did a couple studies. One, we did a study on aging patients, because they normally have these lesions, these oxidations of their membrane as they get older. And so if you take patients that are above 65 or 70, and those subjects in general have a less efficient mitochondria compared to young adults. And one of the things that we were able to do was a combination of using a combination of antioxidants and a technique that I call lipid replacement therapy. And I've just written a review on this, which will come out in the next issue of the Journal of the American Nutraceutical Association. Using lipid replacement therapy and antioxidants, we were able to reverse this process. And in aging patients, their mitochondrial function went back within 30 to 60 days to looking like a young adult. And they no longer had the severe fatigue that they had before. Their severe fatigue measured on the Piper fatigue scale went from a severe down to mild to moderate. And so that was a dramatic change. And, of course, if we took them off the product, it just slowly went back again. So
you want to mention the product just for my curiosity?
Well, the product is called NT Factor. In fact, if somebody's interested, they can go online to a website called www.ntfactor.com. So ntfactor.com is the website, so you can learn more about this particular product. And then we also did a study on a combination of that product plus some vitamins and minerals in a product called Propex, P-R-O-P-A-X. And there's a website for that, which is www.propex.com. These two products both have the NT factor, and the NT factor is what's really important in repairing the mitochondria. So in chronic fatigue syndrome patients and in these aging patients, we were both able to, both those groups showed a 35% to 40% increase in their mitochondrial function within 30 to 60 days of taking the product. And that's pretty amazing. It repaired the mitochondrial membranes. I take it myself every day. I've got my parents on it. They're doing much better. And so I think it's one of these things that is going to explode in the future, because there's so many people that are fatigued. I mean, I hear this complaint all the time. And that's one reason why we decided to start doing some studies on just fatigue itself. Now, how does this relate to the infections? The infections that we've been discussing this evening, all of these infections release species of reactive oxygen, as they're called, or ROS, reactive oxygen species, that attack the membranes of the cell, and particularly they attack the mitochondrial membranes, which are very sensitive to these reactive oxygen species. So if you have these intracellular bacterial infections, they'll produce these reactive oxygen species, which will damage the membrane of your mitochondria. And that's one of the major reasons why you have fatigue. So treating the infection and repairing the damage and using antioxidants as well to prevent it further damage, all of this is very, very important, we think.
Now, first, when you refer to antioxidants, are you referring to vitamin E and vitamin C?
Correct. Those are the two principal antioxidant vitamins.
Now, of course, are they included in either of those products that you mentioned, the NT factor or the Propax?
Yes, they are.
And so you just take large doses of that, and then, of course, these other factors that will repair the lipids and supposedly get the mitochondria working again?
That's what we found, and it seems amazing, but it works.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I'm sure there are answers out there. It's just a matter of knowing.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Stan, I will send you some of this product so that you can try it yourself.
All right, I'll take you up on it. I'm a good person, of course, to use it on. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we're certainly talking about the chronic infections that really plague so many people today that we certainly did not see, as at least anywhere near as frequently in years past as we do today. And, of course, we've listed all of them, whether it be chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or Lyme disease. And then, of course, the super infections along with those, the chlamydia, pneumonia, the mycoplasm, Coxiella, the human herpes virus 6, the brucella, the rickettsial infection. Now, if you take these products, does it help you fight off the infection, or does it just tend to reverse the disastrous effects of the infections?
Well, I think it actually helps you fight the infection, because one of the things you need to fight the infection is energy, of course. And if your energy systems are run down, and you just don't feel capable of fighting off the infection. So it does, I think, help in fighting the infection. It also helps your immune system. It strengthens your immune system, and that's essential in preventing these infections to hide. Now, we've been saying that these types of infections hide from the immune system, but in fact, when they spread from organ to organ, they have to escape from the cells. They have to get out, and they have to spread around. So that's the one time that they are susceptible to the immune system. And of course, whenever your immune system gets run down, then you're susceptible to all kinds of different infections. And so then we're not talking about just a small number, then we're probably talking about large number of different types of infections that can get hold in your body. And so it's very important to have a strong immune system.
And, of course, anything that we can do to build up that immune system, I think, is so vitally important. And you actually have an area there on your webpage that goes into how to build up the immune system, don't you?
Oh, yes. There are a number of different products, and the first thing I generally have to tell, particularly radio audience, is that no one can tell you what is best for you. You just have to really try it. Most of these products are not prescription products. They're over-the-counter products that you buy as food supplements and you take, and they do, in many cases, boost your immune system. But some products will work better on you than on somebody else, and so you just have to try them to see what works best. So we list a number of different products that have shown benefit in different patients and so on, and part of that's our own work, part of it is feedback from physicians that we work with and so on and so forth. So part of that's clinical trials that have been published and so on. So there are a number of these things. You just have to try them. But we do suggest that patients, particularly that have these chronic illness problems, take immune boosting or immune support supplements.
Now, glutathione, one of those, is that a worthwhile substance to take?
Well, glutathione, I think if it's in the right form, might be useful. It's difficult to get glutathione from an oral source into our cells and into our body, because it just isn't transported so easily. It's oxidized very easily along the way. So it's better in a way to stimulate systems that actually produce reduce glutathione inside our cells. And so there are a number of ways to do that.
All right. Well, we got Kurt calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Kurt. How are you doing?
Fine. I've got a number of specific questions, and you were probably expecting my call.
No, I wasn't, as a matter of fact. Well, but, of course, I suppose I should have been, because I know that Kurt's been very interested in Lyme disease.
Well, Lyme disease, but also, how does Candida fit in with this picture?
All right, that's a good question. What about Candida?
That is a good question, because, again, whenever you have immune system problems, whenever you have metabolic problems, whenever you have dietary problems and so on, Candida or yeast fungal infections can take hold, and they cause a lot of problems when they're there. In general, we suggest a number of ways in which these should be and can be controlled. One is diet, and if necessary, taking antifungal medicines and medications. Some of these are, there's some natural over-the-counter products, and there are, of course, there are prescription products which are quite effective as well. This is a general problem that a lot of people have, and I think those people have to get on the right diets. That's the first thing. The second thing is that they have to take certain supplements and so on, which will tend to suppress those types of infections, and then, if necessary, take prescription drugs, which actually directly treat the fungus inside of us.
Now, one thing is, how How is candida, or is candida related to some of these, I forget the term you've used.
Chronic infections.
Well, Dr. Martin was into that research.
Well, of course, Dr. Michael, Martin was talking about these viruses that he calls stealth viruses.
Right. Are they related to candida?
No, they're not. In fact, we've also taken a look at the C and V-like viruses as well as HHV6 viruses, and we do find those in a subset of patients as well. I didn't mention that, but it's one of the studies that we've done. So there are a number of viral and bacterial infections that we find. There are also fungal infections that you find in patients. And of course, you're talking about the candida is put in the fungal category. And that type of infection is different from bacteria, and it's different from viruses.
Okay,
so
now.
Bacteria do not have a cell nucleus. Yeast and fungus have a cell nucleus. So they're a little bit different from the bacteria. And, of course, viruses are, you know, little compact balls with a little bit of nucleic acid and surrounded by a protein lipid outer core. And they really don't have the structures that we see in the other microorganisms.
Well, now, as far as the candida, isn't this really, you get this when your immune system is not properly oriented, or does it sort of come on independent of that?
Well, both. I mean, you know, immune disorders... of course, can cause a problem. Diet can cause a problem. Stress can cause a problem. So there are a number of factors related to the immune system, related to diet, related to your general health condition, and so on, that can cause these types of things to rear their ugly head and cause major problems.
Well, you know, there's books out there, and of course, they attribute all the problems of the world to candida. Infections. And then, of course, there are other books that, you know, they will pick out some other substance. And really, it's sort of a combination of all of them, isn't it?
That's what we've been saying all along. And although people point to us and say, well, you say it's mycoplasma. No, that's not exactly what we say. We say it's chronic infections. So chronic infections can be fungal, they can be bacterial, they can be viral, and it's usually a combination.
Okay. Kurt, you have another question.
Oh, yeah, I got a couple more. I've been writing them down here.
All right.
Now, there was a research doctor here in town, a retired doctor, who was doing research. I'm not going to mention his name without his permission, but he was doing research in it. And one of the claims he had is that places like Santa Cruz or the western islands of Hawaii and certainly many of the tropical countries, like in Southeast Asia or whatever, and then also the must on the potatoes in the potato famine produced diseases, and the claim is that the candida is passed on as a venereal disease, so it goes to the children generation after generation. Have you heard anything about any further research on that? I'm part Irish and have had candida and Lyme disease both. And by the way, the Lyme disease support group says that most everybody that has Lyme, because of the excessive antibiotics they take, wind up with candida. And
let's get a comment on that.
Yeah.
Okay, let me comment on that, because a lot of people don't take antibiotics correctly. And there are a number of things that you must do when you take antibiotics. Because the antibiotics, knock down the gut flora, because most of them are taken orally, they wipe out the gut flora, the natural bacteria in our gut, several kilos of natural friendly bacteria in our gut. These have to be replaced, and if they're not replaced, major problems occur. And a lot of times we attribute people getting in trouble with antibiotics because they don't take probiotics after the antibiotics. So we actually recommend pretty massive quantities of these probiotics, these friendly bacteria, to replace the gut bacteria. And if you don't do that, then there are other pathogenic organisms that are going to take the place of the gut bacteria. And candida is one of these. So diet helps control that. Probiotics help control that. There are other things that help control it as well. Antifungals, for example. But if you've got to really work on these, if you have these problems, because once you get it, it's hard to get rid of.
Okay, Kurt, next question.
Well, what about a source of probiotics? What would be a source there?
Well, there are different probiotic, concoctions that are out there on the market. I think probably most of them are fairly good. If they have 10 to 12 or 15 billion live organisms in the product, a lot of these products don't have that number. And we recommend lots. So the more the better. And it doesn't seem that you can overdo it. With these friendly bacteria, you can take a lot of it. But most of the products that are out on the market come in an encapsulated form. They come in little capsules. And they have generally between 6 to 10 billion live organisms per capsule. And if I were to make a recommendation, I would say take four of those capsules 2 hours after any antibiotic, for example, to replace the gut flora as a minimum. And that would just be, a rough estimate. Now, to the types of probiotics, the basic probiotic is a lactobacillus probiotic, lactobacillus acidophilus. That's the basic one. Now, they add to that generally anywhere from 2 to 6 other friendly bacteria. And some people claim that, well, you need a mixture of 2 or 3 of these friendly bacteria to really replace your gut flora and have it like it was before. I don't know if that's all that important or not. I think the important thing is the number. You've got to have a large number of these friendly bacteria present. And maybe if you have a mixture, that might be better, but you absolutely have to have the number. And so we actually recommend that people take a lot of these things, and they take it 2 hours after the antibiotics. The reason for that is that most of the common antibiotics that are used are absorbed within a couple hours by our gut. And so, they're gone from the gut, but the bacteria in the gut they're stressed, they're killed, and so on, and they need to be replaced. So every time you take an antibiotic, 2 hours later, you should be taking probiotics. In addition, you should be taking them twice a day as well on top of that.
Now, what about Diflucan? What does it do?
I'm sorry, what was the question, Kurt?
The medicine called Diflucan, which is used for candida.
Well, Diflucan is an antifungal medication. It's a prescription medication that is prescribed to treat fungal infections and so on. And we found that it's very useful. There are some others that are fairly useful as well. All of these should be used in moderation, because you don't want to select for a resistant strain of fungus or bacteria or anything else for that matter. But they can be quite useful for certain patients.
What about the risks of large doses?
Well, again, it's like I said before. You've got to work on the diet. You've got to work on the probiotics first, I think, and then if you can't control it with that, then you've got to go to an antifungal. But we suggest to people try the easy stuff first, the over-the-counter approach first, and if that works, fine. You don't have to go to the prescription drugs to control it.
Well, I'm thinking...
Of course, the drug companies hate me for saying that, but...
Well, I'm thinking of someone that took large doses for a long period of time, a year or two, of Diflucan, several a day, and had no effect on the candida at all.
Well, I think by then they probably had resistant strains that arose by then. So you have to be a bit careful about the antibiotic and the antifungal and certainly the antiviral, which are generally they're much more toxic than either of the other two. But prolonged use is something that you try and get away from as soon as you can. So we always recommend the people, when they have these, they have to take these medications, that they take them only as long as they need them. And then if they don't need them any longer, try to switch to over-the-counter, more natural products as much as possible to try and control any residual infection.
Well, the last
question. A lot of these things, you just can't knock down the infection unless you start with one of these powerful drugs.
Well, Kurt, let's get to the last question now.
Yeah. The last question, this particular individual had picked up a parasite in a tropical country, and we were wondering if the parasite was somehow, interfering with the Diflucan, and also is Diflucan a dangerous drug?
Well, what sort of a parasite?
It looked like on the back of the neck and other parts of the body, armpits and fingernails and all, looked a lot like ringworm, had a purplish...
Okay. You're talking really about a skin fungus, something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're talking about, again, if you get multiple fungal infections, that's, that can be as difficult as multiple bacterial infections. And so these multiple infections are just more difficult to manage than simple infections. And, of course, it's completely logical that should be the case. And so, you just have to work harder at doing that. And of course, if it's not managed properly, and there are multiple infections that get hold, it just becomes much more difficult in the long run to really make progress.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, my telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, it's difficult for Dr. Nicholson to answer all the questions without seeing patients, and he's certainly not here to try to diagnose, just to talk in general terms about these chronic disabilities, these chronic infections which are increasingly plaguing our population. And, of course, in the process of the treatment, you take antibiotics, and that does kill the friendly bacteria. So you've got to stay ahead of that by taking these probacteria, probiotics, so that you maintain the normal flora of the gut, so that the bad organisms or the yeast doesn't take over. So it's a, it's really a very major project to undertake prolonged treatment. Now, are you talking about taking these antibiotics for a matter of months?
Well, most people, unfortunately, that have these chronic smoldering infections have to take them for months. It just doesn't do any good otherwise, and in fact it can worsen the situation by selecting out resistant substrains if they're not treated long enough. So because of that, there are a lot of other things that have to be done. It's not just like a simple 10-day course of antibiotics.
And of course, you want them to get their immune system built up. You want them to alter their diet, and you have most of these things up in your webpage, don't you?
Yes, we do, and I'm a big bugaboo about diet, because what we've found, unfortunately, is patients don't change their diets around, it's unlikely that they're going to get well. Generally, if they've been sick a long time, they absolutely have to change their diet. And so we give some dietary advice on the website, and we think that that's very important.
All right. Of course, as far as the overall approach to this is concerned, why it's really a matter of a really prolonged treatment. Would you say it'd be a matter of a 2 or 3 months of antibiotic treatment to really overcome this? Or are we talking 6 months?
Well, most physicians that treat these illnesses, and I have to say that because we're more of a clearinghouse than anything else, although we do run IRB-approved clinical trials, and we have physicians that operate at the Institute for Molecular Medicine. We're not a clinic, we don't generally see patients unless they're part of a clinical trial that we're running, in which case we have the research nurses and physicians that are attending to that particular trial. So we depend a lot on feedback from the community, from physicians in the community, or from physicians that we enroll into various clinical trials. And I'm working on one right now, for example, that has institutions in New York, various places around the country. So it's a large multi-center trial, and they're very difficult to run, as you can imagine. So we're trying to do these sorts of things to try and get as many as people as possible enrolled in these sorts of trials. But it's very difficult, and it's very expensive. It's very hard to find sponsorship for this. And the types of chronic illnesses that we deal with are kind of orphan illnesses in a way. Chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, even the rheumatic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, they're almost orphan diseases. Why? Because most of the research money does not go into chronic disease. Most of the research money goes other places. So it's very hard to compete for that very small amount of research funding that's out there. So we do what we can.
Well, let's go to Troy, who's calling from Pacific Grove. Hi, Troy. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Thanks a lot. And thank you, Dr. Nichols.
Just speak up a little louder, Troy.
Okay.
Yeah, I can barely hear him.
I said thank you very much for all the information that you've given us through the years here. I'm a 6.5 year into trying to recover from a head injury. And I didn't recover well, and developed a lot of strange syndromes. I've been called bizarre by quite a few doctors. And I've also determined that I have mycoplasma infection.
How did you determine that?
There was a blood test and a biopsy that was done by a pathologist here in town.
All right, so have a question or comment.
Well, in searching for treatment, I ended up going through 9 doctors, and I ended up with a VA doctor that when I confronted him and said I didn't feel like I was getting the truth or very good medicine or science, you know, could he help me out? And he showed me something, and I was wondering, Dr. Nichols, whether you've noticed this in looking at your patients. He said, I can show you what the problem is. And he held my hand up, and he said, do you see the lines running down the pads of the inner part of your hand? And I said, yes. And he says, well, they come from here. And he pointed at the cuticle. And he said, that's the problem. And, you know, I've pretty much been trying to notice through the years now that everyone has these lines down their hands. And, you know, that would be a candida.
Well, that sounds pretty far out to me. Have you ever heard anything like that, Dr. Nicholson?
No, I mean, you know, people that are chronically ill are much more susceptible to fungal infections. And, of course, they get these under the nails and they get them in the gut and so on and so forth. You know, but I've never heard of that particular.
This stays fairly benign, okay, other than a little bit of minor irritation at the fingernail once in a while. The only thing that I'm saying about this is that the, you were talking earlier about how all of these diseases that seem to have lain fairly dormant for a while seem to be fairly active now, and that the paradigm may be shifting quite a bit. And
well, that may be true, and of course, what you're referring to may actually be the fact that if someone's immune system is compromised and is not functioning properly, then you'll pick up all these superficial infections. You'll notice, you know, skin lesions and fungal growths under the nails and so on will be much more common than if your immune system was operating at full strength. And so I think that may be one of the things that...
You know, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying.
What are you saying, Troy?
I'm saying that the fingernail looks normal, but the lines are there nonetheless.
Oh, you're talking the lines on the fingernail?
No, the lines grow up the finger towards the palm of the hand and then continue across the palm and become very faint and very invisible, but actually ended up growing all over the complete body.
Okay, well, I really don't know anything about that, but thanks so much for calling, Troy. Let's go to Theodora here. Hi, Theodora. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do, and I'm glad to hear you again, Dr. Garth Nicholson, because I do hand out your website to many people. But I'm somebody who is low income and deals with a lot of low income people, and so I'm always looking for affordable solutions. And I work with hydrogen peroxide and colloidal silver, and I'm wondering if you've had any positive or otherwise experience using them as remedies.
All right. The question is, what about peroxide? What about certainly colloidal silver? Do you have any thoughts on those?
Well, certainly the peroxide, which I put in the category of oxidative therapy, and of course it's done in different ways in different communities. For example, ozone therapy is very popular in Nevada. It's less popular here in California, so is peroxide, because if a practitioner uses this, they may have some problems with the medical board. But I think these oxidative therapies are very useful for the following reason, that a lot of the infections that I've been discussing, if not virtually all of them this evening, are what's known as borderline anaerobic infections. That is, they prefer low oxygen concentration. And when you give oxygen, you tend to suppress their growth. And that's why when people that have these infections, for example, and have to fly a lot, like we work with pilots, for example, I work with the Airline Pilots Association, and I've had several airline captains that had to help with their chronic conditions. And when they fly a lot under reduced pressure, the oxygen tension is actually lower, and they tend to be more symptomatic, and they have a lot of problems if they do a lot of flying. So, you know, they bunch the flying up in a month of a flight for an airline pilot, and so they were crashing right after their series of flights, and then they're off for a while. They were trying to recover so they could go back again and so on and so forth. So we think that that's a problem. Now, oxidative therapy can help correct that, and we, in fact, have some protocols using hyperbaric oxygen, which is a little easier, I guess, here in California to get hooked up with the hyperbaric centers than it is using peroxide. But peroxide is just another way to do that, and that's to increase the oxygenation. Now, the peroxide can be given superficially. In fact, when the vets came back from the Gulf War, they had a lot of skin problems, and we suggested that they take peroxide baths, and they helped with that problem.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't help with the systemic problems, though. There's only a certain amount of the peroxide that's absorbed through the pores in the skin, even in the hot water, in the way that we had kind of designed it and had them do it, to maximize the amount of oxygen coming in through peroxide through the pores. There are also, a number of ways that people with oral infections can irrigate using peroxide solutions. And in some cases, you can swallow the remainder, but we don't really recommend that because taking oral peroxide can really be damaging to your stomach. And then there's intravenous peroxide administered in very low concentrations because some people react very violently to it, IV. And so that's been used to fight these types of infections, to fight both viral and bacterial infections. And it's effective in certain areas, for example, like in Africa, where they can't afford antibiotics or other drugs. They pretty much have to use some fairly simple things like peroxide solutions and so on, and excess high levels of vitamin C and so on. So they go through these routines where they're given oxidative therapy, and then after the oxidative therapy, they're immediately given antioxidants to counteract any of that so that it doesn't damage the system, because the oxidative therapy, if you overdo it, can damage your system. So do I think that it can be used? Yes, it's certainly been used. There's some people that have used it very effectively in Europe and Germany, for example. It's been used for a long time fairly effectively. It has to be done very carefully and so on and so forth. Somebody really has to know what they're doing, I think, to use that. But it has been used effectively. So oxidative therapy is one of the things that we consider to be important in these areas of chronic illness.
Now, of course, she had mentioned colloidal silver. Do you have any thoughts on...
No, I don't really.
Can I intercede here? Because for anybody listening about the hydrogen peroxide, we're talking food-grade hydrogen peroxide, not the stuff you get at the pharmacy or the drugstore.
Right. You're talking about just taking by mouth.
Anything you're, even if you're going to bathe in it, the commercial stuff has stabilizers and you don't want to absorb those into your body. But food grade is very inexpensive too, but you usually gotta mail order it or.
Okay. Dr. Nicholson, what about rectal ozone and oxygen therapy? I mean, this has been advocated some places I know in Europe. Is there any justification for that?
Well, as I mentioned before, there is a justification for oxidative therapy, and there are a number of ways in which it can be administered, and a lot of it depends upon the physician and what he or she chooses, what method they choose to administer that type of therapy if they decide to use oxidative therapy, whether it's hyperbaric oxygen in a chamber, whether it's hydrogen peroxide or ozone or whatever. There are just a number of different ways that it can be administered.
All right, fine. Theodore, we're out of time.
Well, okay. Well, thanks. Wait for the colloidal silver.
Okay.
Finally, colloidal silver. Well, we haven't really done any studies on colloidal silver, so I can't really comment on it. The only experience we had was from the Gulf War veterans who didn't seem to gain much benefit from colloidal silver. Now, some people claim that certain types of colloidal silver, very small particles and so on and so forth, are effective. Other people claim it's not and so on. We've never really studied it, so I really can't comment on it.
Okay, thanks
thank
so much,
you.
Theodore. And I want to thank you so much. It's been a marathon, but I really appreciate so much your being with us, Dr. Nicholson.
No problem.
Thank you so much. Look forward to having you again in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, thanks for having
bye-bye.
Me on board.
All right, well, that's Dr. Garth Nicholson. I hope you've enjoyed the program. And, of course, till tomorrow evening, pray for America. Pray for those boys who went overseas to fight for freedom and found out, of course, they came home ill, and their families are ill as well. And then, of course, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.